Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Arabs in the streets, change in the air, and big jitters in the palaces and halls of power in the Arab world. In Jordan, they're giving every soldier a pay raise and cutting back the price of food. In Kuwait, they're throwing thousands at every Kuwaiti and hoping for calm. But calm is not the word for the Arab world right now. A remarkable month has put uprising in the headlines, revolution in the headlines. This hour On Point, the fire now across the Arab world. You can join the conversation. What's happening here? How big is it? How real? How lasting? And what will it bring? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Last week in Yemen. Thousands of protesters gathered in the capital calling for the president to step down sooner than he said he will, 2013. The president there saying he'll go then. For some in Yemen, as across the region, that's just not good enough. Here's a protester in Yemen. Let's listen.
We hate promises. It is too late. We have kept asking for reforms and we have been patient up till now. We have even been patient with hunger, but the authorities don't hear us.
We've been patient, no more. We will go to Jordan in this hour, Yemen, Egypt. We'll hear voices of uprising and of royalty. With me here in the studio today is Rami Khoury, internationally syndicated columnist, editor-at-large for Lebanon's Daily Star. He's also director of the Institute of Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University in Beirut, a visiting fellow at the Fares Center at Tufts University. Rami Khoury, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What's going on and how big is it?
It's very big, but it's a process that will take time. This is a process that did not come out of a vacuum. For 2-3 decades, we've had clear indications all across the Arab world in many different forms, student groups, Islamic group, Muslim brothers, professionals, judges, lawyers, all kinds of movements that have been, first of all, expressing their discontent and their discomfort to the ruling authorities in terms of prices, lack of affordable housing, lack of equal opportunity, abuse of power, corruption, many, many different dimensions of people's discontent have been expressed so clearly in so many ways, but have had almost zero impact on the ruling elites. And therefore, this has been a cumulative process. And we've seen bouts of it in Egypt with Kefaya, with the Muslim Brotherhood, mm-hmm. with the April 6th movement, the students, labor unions. We've seen, we had the overthrow of Numeri in Sudan back in 85. You had many expressions all over the regions. Finally, it just got too much. And the spark that did it was something that people couldn't predict. There was this fellow in Bouazizi in Tunisia.
The famous fruit vendor.
Exactly. And then he was a symbol, you know, a mm-hmm. college graduate, and he couldn't get work, and he even tried to just sell fruits to help feed his brothers and sisters, and he wasn't allowed to do that, and a police lady hit him. Mm-hmm. So it was really a fantastic culmination symbol of all of the terrible things that people have complained about. And finally, when it happened, it was a spark that lit off a big fire.
You say what's happening won't necessarily be fast. Of course, it has seemed to people outside that it's been very fast. We went from Tunisia to Egypt in a matter of days, weeks, and then Egypt seemed to be right on the cusp of some complete upheaval. But I think a lot of people will be wondering today if maybe, after all these years, decades and decades and decades of a ruling elite that did not change so much, if this is really going to carry through. I mean, what's the force in this? Egypt seems kind of becalmed at the moment. They're still in Tahrir Square, but, you know, there's Mubarak still in charge, and his lieutenant, now the vice president, Suleiman, not offering much in the way of concessions. Are you so sure there's something real and profound going on here?
Oh, absolutely. There's something real and profound. This is like the best parallel is the Solidarity movement in Poland in 1980. And General Jaruzelski was named mm-hmm. by the Soviets to calm things down and keep the lid on it. And in fact, what happened is, you know, Jaruzelski is Omar Suleiman, and Solidarity is the demonstrators in the street. And this took 10 years in Poland and the Soviet Union to bring down the whole Soviet empire. I think they will need some years for the ripples of this process to work themselves through the Arab world, and different regimes will respond in different ways. Not all regimes are like Tunisia and Egypt. Many of the Arab leaderships have more legitimacy than others. Many have better developmental policies. Many have more humane ruling systems. But there is discontent across the region, which is now widely confirmed by public opinion polling and many other vehicles.
We're going to question and test your assertion in this hour that this is now something kind of that can't be put back in the bottle. We'll look at that, but I want to begin to bring more voices in here. Yemen has been very much in the news. Let's go to Sana'a, Yemen. Abdul Ghani Al-Riyani is with us, development consultant and political analyst based in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Abdul Ghani Al-Riyani, thank you very much for being with us from Yemen.
Thank you for having me.
So we've heard both your leader saying he will step down in 2013, which was a big concession on his part, and we have heard protesters saying that's not good enough. You've had a lot of people in the streets in the last couple of weeks. How confident are you that Yemen is on a new path now?
Well, the clearest example of how profound and irreversible the change in the area is that just before the Tunisia revolution, the two parties in political negotiation here, the ruling party and the opposition, were discussing really mundane concessions on the part of the ruling party, and the opposition accepted them, and the ruling party said no. Right now, the ruling party is offering many times more than what was an offer then, and the people are still saying no. I think that the expectations of people have risen because of what happens in Tunisia and what's happening in Egypt, and it will take a lot to bring back the calm that was before these revolutions.
Here's your Yemeni president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, announcing that he would leave office in 2013 and would not be succeeded by his son. The president said his people's desires took precedence over his own.
No extension, no inheritance, no resetting the clock. I call on the opposition to freeze all planned protests. I present these concessions in the interests of the country. The interests of the country come before our personal interests.
Abdul Ghani Al-Riyani, how are you sure, though, that this will last? 2013 is 2 years from now. A lot can happen in that time. You know, it's hard for people to stay in the streets. The autocratic rulers in your region have been very durable for a long time. Mubarak is still in his palace. Is it possible that this season of protest will pass and the old status quo will reemerge?
Well, to start with, these concessions made by the president were unthinkable just a few weeks ago.
Okay.
So there it is. The difference has already taken place.
Yeah.
Whether he is going to actually commit to that or not, it's now being debated, and the majority are skeptical about him, about his intentions. But I think the people can hold him to his word. And in 2 years, people don't have to stay in the street to implement these promises. They are now engaged in dialogue to set the rules, the conditions, to ensure that these promises will be kept.
Rami Khoury with me here in the studio. What about you? The durability of what we see going on here. How far will it go? Is it over? I mean, Egypt has had a tremendous upheaval, and yet there's Mubarak still in his palace. There's his guy still in charge.
Sure. I think you have to understand a couple of things. First of all, the nature of the grievances being expressed and the nature of the demands being made are both a little bit unclear. I mean, we know what people are complaining about, cost of living, corruption, mm-hmm. abuse of power, etc., etc. But what they actually want to happen, other than Mubarak leaving office, has not been fully articulated, partly because this movement doesn't have a clear center of gravity and leadership. But this will take some time to play itself out. I think the majority of people in the Arab world, from my own views of traveling around the region for the last 40 years and studying it intensively, is that people want orderly, reasonable change. They don't necessarily want to overthrow all the regimes. They're probably willing to do what happened in the Soviet Union, a Gorbachev-type transition from the top with real significant change, but a lot of the elite actually retains a lot of its power, but ordinary people feel that they have their rights and their humanity is affirmed much more clearly. So we should really be patient and to look for signs of significant change. Omar Suleiman taking over from Hosni Mubarak is not a sign of real change. One old general replacing another old general is not a real sign of change. But I think if you see constitutions being changed, accountability mechanisms, and look for two critical things. Will the military and security services and the spending of the central government, including the ruling families, will those come under more public and civilian accountability? And I think if you see any sign of that happening, then you know this is serious.
Abdul Ghani Al-Iryani, do you think you can make that happen in Yemen?
I think we have a good chance. It's not an easy task. And we have a serious gap of credibility in the president and the ruling party. But the situation is such that if nothing concrete is delivered to the people, the possibility of a real eruption is really there. In Yemen, we have not had grassroots movement coming out to the street. It was mostly political parties and their supporters. But more and more people are joining, and it will become a movement that cannot be stopped.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Arab world rethinking its future after Egypt and Tunisia. Behind me, voices from Amman, Jordan, last Friday, demonstrating against the government under King Abdullah II there. We've been joined by Rami Khoury. He's editor-at-large for Lebanon's Daily Star. With us from Sana'a, Yemen, has been Abdul Ghani Al-Iryani, development consultant and political analyst there. We just heard the sound from Jordan. Let's get a voice from Jordan now, quite a prominent one. Prince El Hassan bin Talal is with us from Amman, the capital of Jordan, member of the Jordanian royal family, uncle of the current king, Abdullah II there. He's founder and chairman of the West Asia North Africa Forum. Prince El Hassan bin Talal, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Are we seeing the birth of a new Arab world? If so, what is it?
I think the birth of the new Arab world was pre-World War I, when Lawrence of Arabia and the Arab Renaissance movement were covered as calling for self-determination. That was stymied by the Western powers who colonized this whole region. And what we see is pocket handkerchief side states trying to come out of the control of the new colonialism, which I would summarize in the following. The GCC Security Risk Assessment and U.S. Extended Deterrence, a paper by the Burke Chair at CSIS, tells us the war against terrorism and extremism is going to be a long war that is likely to go on for the next 10 to 20 years. So you have two processes, one of self-empowerment by Arab peoples, who are justifiably frustrated and outraged at the absence of equal opportunity in so many areas of life, at the absence of legislation and due process, and this overwhelming process of the generals. Rami was talking about the aging generals who are simply there because they are useful to be on our side in the war on terror. So how can you have how can you reconcile these two factors? Will the United States and the Western countries, and for that matter, the Asian tigers, look at this region as peoples or as oil and opportunities for arms sales? This is also a crucial factor.
You've described the West as willing to ignore opportunity and rights of the Arab world in order to keep a grip on its on oil interests and Islamic extremism. But surely there have been a lot of governments in your neck of the woods who have been, if that's the way it is, that the local governments have been the tool of that position. Do you see them changing now? Do you think Mubarak will actually go?
He has declared that he's going in September, and sooner or later, obviously, he will leave that office. I don't think that he will be in any position to be reelected. But what comes next is the question. It's not going to be necessarily a happy ever aftering, unless the issue of a regional conference, which I've been mooting for years. Incidentally, I'm a non-governmental organism. I mean, I may be royalty, but I was born that way. I don't think I'm expected to apologize on this program.
All right.
For what I for what I was
for your born. Birth, okay.
But all I want to say is that. In terms of the networking with organizations all over this region, I think that freedom of opinion is what is at stake here today. And will those opinions be relayed after the wheeling and dealing is done between the Vice President and the Constitutional Reform Committee and the Muslim Brothers? After all, Muslim Brothers were asking for their colleagues to be released from jail. Now, are these kinds of trade-offs going to take them off the main issue, which is the future of Egypt, the constitution of Egypt, public freedoms? Are they going to be a party to power, or are they, and indeed all the other opposition figures, including Dr. Baradei, are they going to be able to keep their eye on the ball? Population growth, poverty and deprivation, slow economic development, high illiteracy, high infant mortality, you name it. We have to get back to recognizing the sovereignty of the citizen.
You're not in the government, but you're in a royal family. The region has a number of them. I mean, I guess we're looking on and trying to figure out how thoroughgoing the change, if there is a big change here, how thoroughgoing it is. Do you think... let's say Mubarak goes. That doesn't mean that the whole structure that he's built will go. In country after country in your region, you've got a very deeply installed elite there with its hand on the levers of wealth and power. Are those elites in danger, even in your own country? Will they have to go?
I think all incompetent elites, all immoral elites have to go wherever they may raise their ugly head. I mean, let me just talk about the Palestinian Authority today, which is, after all, under the control of an occupying power. The Palestinian Authority's GNP comes from the U.S., EU, UN, and the World Bank. And according to a recent study, the PA's reliance on donations increased with a 20% growth in donations, totaling some $3.96 per year. So, I mean, I'm totally against patronage and bribery. And totally for building from the bottom up. That's why I served with Madeleine Albright on the legal empowerment of the poor. The commission was meant to meet in Cairo, and the Egyptians apologized at the last minute. So I said, I assume there's no poverty in Cairo, if you'll forgive the irony. And as a member of the Commission for Transitional Democracy in Eastern Europe, I mean, I recognize what was being said earlier about the Jaruzelski, Suleiman look-alike, but the question is not one of personalities now. It's not a journalistic comment alone that we need. I think that when my colleague Mr. Abdel Ghani Liriani pointed out that this is the best that we can get from now to 2013, mm-hmm. I think he said it with some frustration, clearly in his voice. I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth. The point is that Arab leaders, 1980 we came together as an Arab thought forum, and we called and have been calling ever since for someone to listen to the need for an economic and social council for this region that meets every day of every quarter at all levels, government, private sector, and civil society. That way we can talk about mobilization of a new renaissance.
Well, we'll see if it's at a conference table or if it's in the streets. Prince El Hassan bin Talal joining us from Amman, Jordan. Thank you very much for your thoughts today.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's get a call right here. Saad in Los Angeles. Thanks for calling, Saad. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
For the average citizen in that region, I believe there are two scenarios in which they can be ruled, either through a stable dictatorship or chaotic democracy. Neither of the two scenarios are rosy. I think what's going to happen is we're moving into the second scenario in which the so-called democracies are going to take over. And what will happen is there's going to be power vacuums in which they're going to be filled by factions fighting and keep fighting, trying to take control. In general, this is not going to translate into a better life for the average citizen. As a matter of fact, if you look at examples we have right now, we have Iraq, the Palestinians, and Lebanon. These three examples have the so-called democracies going on, and look what is happening, basically.
So, Saad, are you saying that the Arab world is better off leaving its Mubareks in power?
I think neither of the two scenarios are rosy. They're both not going to translate into a better life for the average citizen.
Saad, thanks for calling. Abdul Ghani Al-Iryani in Yemen. Do you see those as the options here, a stable dictatorship or chaotic democracy? Can you not have something in between?
Not at all. I think that there's a basic dichotomy between people in power and the general public. And in the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s and 70s, the people in power had not developed a paradigm to control the people. So we had military coups all the time. By the mid-70s or so, they evolved a mechanism involving layers of security apparatuses and patronage and so on to control their people. And for 30 years, there were no military coups because the paradigm of the power people prevailed. Now, what we see today is the paradigm of people power actually taking shape in the region. And when people discovered they actually could stand.
Abdul, we may have lost you there. Rami, I'm not sure what you sense the conclusion he's going to, that there is another way. Saad says no. It's stable dictatorship or chaotic democracy. What do you say? What do you say?
Yeah, I think Saad exaggerates. I think those are two poles, but there is a huge middle ground in between in which you make a slow transition from a dictatorship to a relatively stable pluralistic democracy and accountability system. Prince Hassan used a very important phrase, sovereignty of the citizen. Mm-hmm. I call it consent of the governed, but it's the same thing. I think this is an incredibly important basic issue that we have to keep our eye on.
Is it a revolutionary idea in itself, the sovereignty of the citizen in this region?
Well, it certainly was in 18th century France and the United States, and people all over the world have been talking about it. But remember, the first documented use of the word freedom and the first attempt to institutionalize the rights of citizens and the control of power of ruling authorities was in second millennium Mesopotamia, that these traditions of citizen rights, controlling the power of the rulers, and having mechanisms of stable governance originated in the ancient Middle East.
But that's a long time ago. It's not what we've seen for such a long time.
No, exactly. The only point I'm making is that these are universal human values. This has nothing to do with France or the U.S. or Poland or Egypt. This is a universal human spirit that people want to live in dignity and freedom, but also order. They don't like chaos, and they feel that their human rights and their political and civil rights need to be affirmed. And this is the main single message coming out of Tunisia and Egypt and spreading across the region. The Arab people have more cumulative history than anybody else in the world in managing urban societies. They have about 6,000 years of this history. So they know how to handle these things if they're given a chance to do so.
But if they have that knowledge, what a revolution it must be for it to return, because that respect for the sovereignty of the citizen is the furthest thing from what we've come to identify with the Arab world in recent years.
The
prisons of Egypt and right on across the autocrats, and yes, Washington has supported them, but what's bringing that back to the fore right now? It's more than one fruit vendor in Tunisia.
Right. Oh, absolutely. What caused the African Americans in 1954 to stop riding on the back of the bus after 150, 200 years of dehumanization? Something happens after generations and generations of abuse and dehumanization and degradation. Something snaps. It snapped with Rosa Parks when she got on that bus. It snapped with those kids in Birmingham who challenged the police and the water hoses and the dogs. And it snapped in Tunis and Egypt last month. So these things come at a moment when we can't predict, but it represents a groundswell, a long tradition of indignity and degradation, and people start to demand making these changes. Just keep in mind, it took the Europeans 500 years to get from the Magna Carta to the French Revolution, and it took you 300 years in this country to move from slavery and only land-owning white men having the vote to get to the point in the mid-1950s when everybody started to get their equal rights. These things take time, even in France and the United States. So give us a little bit of time. This has only been going on for a couple of months. The states that have been created, as Prince Hessen said, around World War I, were quickly taken over by elites and police states and security states supported by the West. So we're seeing, I believe, the first true signs of self-determination, popular self-determination, Arabs trying to define their governments, their value system, their policies, and their accountability mechanisms. It's extremely exciting.
It's very, very exciting stuff, thrilling. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Ali in Brockton, Massachusetts. Ali, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
My question is basically based on John F. Kennedy saying those who make peaceful protest impossible make violent protest inevitable. And basically, my point is, so far since these things have started, we haven't seen the anti-Western burning of flags or effigies of President Obama or anything like that. And I wonder if the West and the U.S. doesn't stop dragging and start to lead on this, does it then turn into anti-Western and anti-American, and are they then justified in having those sentiments if they do start to see that, you know, maybe that the Western world is kind of backing away from immediate reform and putting in basically another military man to deal with?
Ali, I appreciate your call. Certainly, we've seen Washington kind of to-ing and fro-ing just in the last couple of weeks on Egypt, trying to walk a line here. It's not easy. Abdul Ghani Al-Iryani, I think you're back with us. What about the position that Washington takes in Yemen, for example? Ali says he hasn't seen anti-American sentiment in Tahrir Square. I have seen a little. I've heard some of those chants. But what about in Yemen? How important is the position that Washington takes now on these uprisings?
The U.S. government has been supportive of people's right to express their views and has called on both sides to go into negotiation. Their stance so far has been accepted by the people. I think that the problem in Yemen is mostly domestic. Very little international influence is involved. The grievances are, of course, very real, and the concessions that need to be made by the regime have to be substantial.
And there, the United States watches in Yemen as across the region to see what unfolds. Kim in Rock Island, Illinois. Kim, you're on the air.
Well, and a happy Monday. Just wanted to point out that at least since the 70s that I've been aware of, our government has preached bringing democracy around the world and everything, which a lot of us, the people, viewed it as though a lot of the times when we went over there and sent our military over, it was about profit for our businesses or for the oil or different things. Well, to me, this is such a wonderful thing. I mean, these people are wanting to find democracy on their own, and so I think we should support it in all ways. And back to NAFTA, I mean, when they started that, the whole idea was, oh, no, you're going to bring American wages down to these dirt wages that other people get paid. And it was, no, it'll make everybody, you know, pay their people better. And to me, this is going to make our businesses behave better. They're not going to be able to go over there and not abide by safety regulations or environmental regulations. You're not going to be able to pay these people diddly squat. You know, it's a wonderful thing. I'm so happy for these people. I mean, I'll be happier when they finally get to that peaceful point that they're not having to work towards their democracy and you know. But yes, this is wonderful. I just wanted to say how happy I am.
Three cheers from Kim. And Kim, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Abdul Ghani Al-Iryani in Sana'a, Yemen. I want to thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today. Thank you for joining us.
You're most welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Arab world this hour, rethinking its future after Egypt and Tunisia. Here was the president speaking yesterday with Fox News' Bill O'Reilly talking about the situation in Egypt. Here's President Obama.
Here's what we know is that Egypt is not going to go back to what it was. The Egyptian people want freedom. They want free and fair elections. They want a representative government. They want a responsive government.
But there were also big notes of caution. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Germany spoke here with NPR.
Revolutions have overthrown dictators in the name of democracy, only to see the political process hijacked by new autocrats who use violence, deception, and rigged elections to stay in power or to advance an agenda of extremism.
Encouragement and some fear right there, both in big, powerful American voices. Rami Curry joins me in the studio, editor-at-large for Lebanon's Daily Star newspaper. Let's go to Cairo just for a moment here. Gouda Abdelkhalik is with us, professor of economics at Cairo University, a longtime critic of what he calls the crony capitalism of the Mubarak regime. Gouda Abdelkhalik, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Is the uprising that we've all watched into
Egypt,
is your revolution succeeding?
I think so. I'm very hopeful. Egypt is going through a great transformation. The first we've ever seen since the revolution of 1990. So we're talking about a historic moment in the country's history, and it's a galvanizing moment where everybody is running behind the national flag, calling for down to the dictator, a total change of the regime, building a new Egypt, meaning that a new, totally new political system based on freedom, social justice, and equal opportunities for every Egyptian.
Do you believe you can have a stable democracy that's not, you know, rigged for the elites or taken over by Islamic extremists? Can you have it?
Some people have voiced this concern that it may be hijacked by one strand of Egyptian politics or another, and others also point out to some regional elements, particularly Iran. But I actually discount all this. I have been to the Tahrir Square a number of times so far, and you just have to be there to believe what's going on and to appreciate the fundamental change that Egypt is going through. We have a mass movement, absolutely mass movement. It's not organized by any political faction whatsoever. Muslim brothers or otherwise. Nobody, either on the left like myself or the extreme right like other people or the Muslim brothers, no one can claim that he has contributed to leading that. It's a totally autonomous mass movement, but it's not confined to the youth. I would like to say that when you go to the Tahrir Square or watch the demonstrations in city after city in Egypt, you see people of all walks of life, young, old, middle-aged, males, females, women of all social strata, men of all social strata, in addition to youth. This is it's a melting pot that Egyptians are being remade through what started back in January 25th.
Can your uprising, maybe even revolution, can it still fail? Can the powers that be come in and stop it?
I don't want to belittle the viciousness of the counter-revolution. We've seen appearances of that last Wednesday when brutal forces armed with very primitive but vicious weapons attacked the peaceful demonstrators in Tahrir Square. We don't know exactly what's happening at the security front, and this is a big lacuna right now. Reports have it that some elements connected to the previous Minister of Interior are trying to undermine what's going on. You hear the Vice President speaking, the Prime Minister speaking, and when we ask them, okay, what happened with this total absence of security in the Egyptian state, they say, we really don't know, and we are trying to find out. That is very alarming. If you consider that over 30 years, a tiny elite, which I call crony capitalism, has grown so fast and has amassed so much wealth, although that was transferred outside Egypt and it still remains there, there is a big cleavage between the Hand and Hamas. Definitely, I should expect the elements of the counter-revolution to fight back. The only assurance is the determination of the people on the street, backed by all Egyptians of all walks of life. But still, the danger is still there. I think the coming week is going to be a critical week as far as the fate of the Egyptian revolution is concerned.
Egypt still very much in the thick of its uprising. Fate undecided. Gouda Abdel Khalik at the Cairo University, professor of economics there. Thank you so much for joining us from Cairo. Rami Khoury, I want to hear you on that and more, but we've got lots of listeners with observations. Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Scott's calling. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. It just seems to me that it's obvious that the result of all this is going to be determined by whether or not the revolts in these various countries is taken over by the or hijacked by the terrorists and those who are seeking to install conservative Islamic regimes. If it's simply a matter of democracy and they can hold that, then there's a chance this can work out. Otherwise, you're going to be right back where we were before in the Middle Age with the conservatives trying to take care of the Israel, fight a war against them, and which will spread to all the others. So it's very risky in the sense that if the Arabs or the Islamist conservatives unite, then it's going to be awfully hard for the West to keep from a war over Israel and all the other interests, even Turkey sliding that way. And it just seems to me that everything depends upon how Egypt turns out and whether it can resist the temptation to have terrorists take over.
Scott, I appreciate your call. I mean, you're framing it in a way I think there's no small number of Americans who, in one way or another, have some version of this fear. Rami Khoury, speak to it, please.
Well, I mean, I could speak for 3 hours on that, but I'll just make three very quick points. The first one is the United States, whether it's Scott or Hillary Clinton or anybody else, has zero credibility in talking about the dangers of violence and extremism in the Middle East when the neocon American government unleashed the most destructive war in Iraq that has created millions of refugees, wasted trillions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of people dead, and unleashed the Sunni Shiite genie. So the fear of violence and extremism in the Middle East is indigenous in Washington as it is in the Middle East.
You're saying America has brought its own batch of that. But back up for a minute. Scott looks at what's going on and he says that he fears the terrorists taking over.
Well,
now, a lot of those people in Tahrir Square, they may look like terrorists to Hosni Mubarak, but they sound like people talking democracy.
Right.
But speak to the concern that within or behind or at some later point comes an Islamic extremist element that may push more moderate voices out of the way.
Sure. The second point I was going to make is that precisely that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is by and large a nonviolent group. The violent people went off and joined bin Laden in Afghanistan or were crushed by the regime. Mm-hmm. So the terrorists have been defeated by their own country there in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood has been largely absent from this process on the street as they were in Tunisia as well. So I think the idea that people should fear the Islamist movements is premature. The third point I would make is when we see Islamist movements take power or share in power in the Arab world or Islamic region, they generally don't do very well. There is not widespread popular support for, say, the Muslim Brothers turning Egypt into an Islamic state.
You say it's premature, this concern, and you may well be right, but speak to Americans, look at Iran. This has been an Islamic government that's been there for a long time now.
Well, it's not an Islamic government. It's a bunch of thugs. They were a legitimate Islamic revolution.
Took power yes.
Yeah, when they overthrew the Shah, they had widespread support, but then they turned into just another Middle Eastern regime. And I think a majority of Iranians are critical of their government and don't identify with this ideology. ideology that smaller and smaller number of people espouse.
But our caller Scott might look and say, well, okay, you can say that it's not an Islamic government, it's thugs, but it took over in the name of Islam in a time of turmoil. It's certainly opposed to Israel. I mean, the scenario that he fears would seem to be borne out in the Iranian case.
Yeah, but Iran is completely different. Mm-hmm. A better example is Turkey, where Islamist movements who were repeatedly put down and imprisoned and banned by an American-supported military government in Turkey over 20, 30 decades. Mm-hmm. Finally, the Islamists won through democratic means, did a good job, were elected three times, and have become extremely secular, strong democratic, constitutional, and republican principles, a vibrant economy, and a tremendous example to people all over the region. So the point I'm making is, if people speak in the language of religion and ethics and morality and democracy, let's not only listen to the religion part, let's listen to the ethics and morality and democracy. Martin Luther King used a religious vocabulary seeking civil rights. Bishop Tutu in South Africa used a religious vocabulary. If the people using Islamic vocabulary are peaceful and they are legitimate in the eyes of their own societies, they must be given a chance to compete like everybody else. There's no doubt in my mind, I know these people, Hezbollah, Hamas, Muslim Brothers. I've been dealing with them, talking to them, interviewing them, drinking coffee with them for 30, 40 years. These people are a strong, credible minority in their societies. There is no demand for Islamic rule, Islamic governments in Arab countries. People in the Arab world cheer Ahmadinejad, but they don't want to go live in Iran. They cheer Ahmadinejad because he badmouths the United States and Israel. So I think we need to separate political resentments and anger from the basic desires of ordinary people. And we have to see a process in the Arab world where one country allows a really free political system to emerge. And the Muslim Brothers, I predict, will, in a free election in Egypt, with others competing, will probably get about maybe 20, 25% of the vote. It's like George Wallace in the South. They'll get a certain it's like the Sarah Palin. They'll get 20%, but these extremist movements will never have the majority supporting them.
We're talking about Arabs standing up in the Arab world and what that means. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Richard in Belmont, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I've been hearing a lot in this call about civil rights and equal opportunity and justice and so forth. And the last conversation, I think, really points to the issue that we need also to talk about civil responsibilities. What are the responsibilities that go from that freedom and from having those rights? And too often we just talk about the freedom without talking about the responsibilities and the ethics that are involved in a democratic society.
Many people are saying those are being demonstrated in Tahrir Square. Does that give you some confidence about a future if these movements are successful, Richard?
I think it's absolutely terrific. It's heartwarming to hear and to see, in fact, the taking up of those responsibilities, the determination to be nonviolent, and the communities that have developed voluntarily by that. And I'm just saying that we need to talk more about what those responsibilities are rather than just talk the right side and the freedom side. But in fact, Egypt is a beautiful example of where the people have assumed huge amounts of responsibilities as civilians, and to me that's just really heartwarming. And we need to talk more about how that happens and how to make sure that that happens elsewhere, including in our own country.
Richard, thank you very much for your call. What about if Egypt makes it? And I'd like to hear how you're calling that at this moment. Do you think they'll get beyond this enormous power structure that's grown up in decades of the Mubarak regime? Will they get beyond it? And then let's not leave here without addressing the Israel question, because there is a lot of sentiment on that front. And if we see these movements successful across this Arab region, what does that mean for the future of its relationship with Israel, for Israel's future?
Yeah, I think that if we see an orderly transition going on in Tunisia and Egypt, and we'll see it in other Arab countries for sure in the next couple of years, I think we will have a pretty stable, acceptable situation. The nature of the democratic governments that will emerge in this region will reflect the powerful trends in the area, and the three most powerful ones are tribalism, Arabism, and Islamism. Those three are the big, powerful identities that drive ethics, morality, and the structure of society and how power is exercised.
Is that a stable triad?
Well, they're elements. I mean, some people feel more Arab, some people feel more Islamic, some people feel tribal, some people tell you, well, I'm a Kuwaiti, I'm a Jordanian, I'm an Arab, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Greek Orthodox Christian journalist, so, mm-hmm. you know, what am I? Mm-hmm. But I'm an Arab. You know, mm-hmm. you ask me, what am I? I tell mm-hmm. you, I'm a Levantine Arab.
Yeah.
And my Christian identity, my professional identity, my Jordanian, Palestinian identity are elements of my identity. So I think that if we give the people in the Arab world an opportunity, which they've never had, an opportunity, neither by the colonial rulers, nor by their own autocrats, nor by the military security services, they've never had an opportunity to find themselves.
Israel, we just have a minute. It's a big issue. Will they, can they live with it?
I think it's clear that the Arab world has expressed a willingness to live in peace and normal relations with Israel based on the Arab peace plan of 2002, on the condition that Israel also give the Palestinians their rights. I believe that a negotiated peaceful arrangement can be worked out, but not by the people ruling Israel and Palestine right now. I think you need more enlightened rulers.
But Israel has an elected government right now, so what does that mean?
Sure, it has an elected government in which the foreign minister is seen by most of the world as an extremist, almost racist ethnic cleanser.
Nevertheless, if you get Israeli democracy, now if we have Arab democracy, can they get along?
Oh, absolutely. I think if you see examples where Arabs and Israelis interact, they can get along, but they can only get along on the basis of the rule of law, equal rights for all people, applied equally and not with discrimination and favoritism.
Rami Khoury, editor-at-large for Lebanon's Daily Star newspaper. It's been great having you with us. Right now, a visiting fellow at the Farah Center at Tufts University as well. Much more to come here, but we're grateful for your time and thoughts today. Thank you so much, Rami.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. When you go to Facebook, On Point Radio, hit the like button, become a fan, you'll get the early word on upcoming shows there. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.